Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 66, the Homebrew Genomics Club.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to get the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today, we're going to talk about genomics, and the education required to learn genomics. Our guest is Dr. David Botstein. And in 1980, he and three colleagues proposed in a key paper a method for mapping human genes that laid out the groundwork for the Human Genome Project. Later on, in a collaboration with Patrick Brown, he watched the genome in action using DNA microarrays to study system-wide gene expression patterns in yeast and human cancers. Dr. Botstein received his bachelor's degree from Harvard University, doctorate from the University of Michigan. He taught at MIT from 1967 to 1988, served as VP Science at Genentech before joining the faculty at Stanford School of Medicine. 2003, he was named director of the Lewis Sigler Institute for Integrative Genomics and Anthony B. Evnin Professor of Genomics at Princeton University. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and Institute of Medicine. He's received numerous rewards, including recently the Albany Medical Center Prize in Medicine and Biomedical Research. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
To preface this, I've invited Andre Nantel, who's our subject matter expert in the area of genomics. He is a professor at McGill University and a senior research officer at Montreal's Biotechnology Research Institute Microarray Lab at the National Research Council of Canada. Welcome, Andre. I appreciate you coming on to help with this interview.
It's a pleasure to be here. When you said it was going to be Dr. Botstein, I've been reading his paper since I was a graduate student, so it was a pleasure to be here. Even though I'm writing a grant, nice and I'm very busy today.
Yeah. I still can't see anybody, you know.
We can see you, and that's what's really critical. Okay. And you know what? To be honest, we should move our videos away from the screen because once we get into the subject matter, it becomes very difficult to follow the video and talk about, or at least for me, genomics. So it'll come on. This is bleeding edge technology. So let's get to the first big question. And you know, our mission at Futures in Biotech really is to get a firsthand account from the scientists that were involved in all the great science that went on in the past and on today. And I'd really like to know, firsthand, how the Human Genome Project got started. And if you could tell me a little bit about your 1980 mapping paper with Davis and colleagues, it'd be really great if you could.
Sure. As you know, from the beginning, geneticists understood that humans were not going to be different from other animals in the way traits are inherited, at least sensible geneticists thought that. And very early, as early as 1903, just a few years after the rediscovery of Mendel, Galton and all those guys, Garrod, found alkaptonuria, and he and Bateson quickly figured out that the fact that it was so much more common to see an alkaptonuria in inbred families than in outbred families could easily be explained by Mendel. So everybody knew that what was true for Drosophila, at least in terms of the major ideas of of inheritance was going to be true of humans. But there was no way to actually do anything that geneticists would call their natural work, like crosses and making mutants and stuff like that in humans. And and this had been a major problem for human geneticists. I actually got my degree in a department of human genetics, and there was really very little you could do. I was, by the way, studying phage in that department. That was what you could do. So when I was involved in a review at the University of Utah of their genetics program, there was a discussion, and there was a young fellow named Kravitz who worked with Mark Skolnick, who was using the families in Utah to try to understand the inheritance of hemochromatosis. And he was giving a little talk. You know, this was a review of the training grant that they had. And a big argument erupted among the Utahns about whether or not you could learn anything by family studies. And what Kravitz had found was linkage, in modern terms, linkage to HLA. I was in the unique position of being able to understand the molecular side of the guys who were objecting, who objected even to statistics. Their view was that if you had to use statistics, you should just do a better experiment. The guys like Skolnick, you know, because I was probably the only guy who understood what a LOD score was other than Kravitz and Skolnick. And so I got into this mediating position, and suddenly I said something like, well, the only thing that's important about HLA is that it's very polymorphic, that there are many different alleles at the same locus. And if we had markers anywhere else, they would be just as good. And as soon as that those words were out of my mouth, I realized that, in fact, the technology existed to do that. And so we all got excited about that. We pretty much forgot about reviewing and spent the rest of the weekend, this was at Alta, talking about how this would work. And in a couple of days, we pretty much had the outlines of how you could map genes in humans using DNA polymorphisms. In those days, the only thing we knew about were transposon insertions and stuff like that, and restriction fragment changes, and so we proposed using that.
So that was already. Maybe you could go ahead, Andre. Yeah.
Well, these technologies, they were not being used in simpler organisms at the time.
Oh, yes, they were. Absolutely, they were being used. But the idea of using them backwards, as it were, that is to say, the idea of not arranging crosses, but figuring out how the inheritance of little pieces of chromosome went through meiosis in retrospect in existing families. That was what was new, and that hadn't really been done. There were precedents of using restriction fragment differences to map genes. We had done it for the ribosomal RNA genes in yeast, and Olson had done it for the tRNA genes of yeast. In both those cases, one had probes from biochemical isolation of the RNA. In fact, there was a very nice paper by Joe Sambrook and Terry Grotziker in which they had used differences in restriction maps to map TS mutants in adenovirus, which had been a few years before 1978 when this discussion was going on. Our papers, the Olson and ours, were 77. I think. I think that Grotziker and Sambrook was a couple of years before that. Remember that that was just the beginning of restriction fragments at that time.
Right. Before we talk about the restriction fragments, so that we can translate this to the wider audience. Now, that was a really concise description of the relationship between linkages and or sort of the use of linkages to map out the human genome. So a linkage is that where you have a genetic allele that is linked to a number of other traits, and then by the distance, you can statistically evaluate the distance between those two genes. Similar,
yes.
To
just like you do in Drosophila. So the whole idea of the relationship between physical distance and linkage was first inferred by Sturtevant when he was a sophomore or something, undergraduate at Columbia in 1913. There's a wonderful paper that he wrote, in which he shows that you can order the markers along a linear line by using the frequencies of recombination, and that's the same principle. What's new here is the idea of using a physical piece of DNA, which you labeled as a actual physical landmark, and so you actually could the gene was not just a trait; it was also a physical piece of DNA, and that meant you could immediately figure out, for example, what chromosome you're on by in situ hybridization or something like that.
Now, just to put our listeners in context of how things were in those days, so we're talking about the late 70s. I was an early teenager. Mark probably wasn't even born then.
Yeah, I was.
what was the state of molecular biology in those days?
Well, molecular biology in those days involved a lot of radioactivity. There were no fluorescent labels to speak of. So everything was done by labeling with radioactive elements. Ham Smith had figured out that restriction fragments cut specifically specific sequences in DNA only a few years before. And Ed Southern in 1975 had published the idea of chopping up the whole genome, running a gel and separating them by size, and then labeling with a radioactive probe and finding out where your gene was on which restriction fragments. Had that only been published as I said, in 1975. So things were moving very fast.
Well, that take, X-Files by 1995. You see Scully holding up a gel and the image of the radioactive label. That was pretty...
It's a staple of Law and Order. You know, they show you basically an RFLP diagram. You know that CODIS, which is the FBI registry for DNA patterns, still uses RFLPs as pretty much in the form that we proposed in 1980.
Wow. This brings me back to an interview that we did with Oliver Smithies, and he described how he put together the first high resolution gel electrophoresis. So
what do you mean high resolution? Any resolution. He invented the whole thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And he actually put it on the command
module. You know
what
they did before that? You know how they how Pauling showed that hemoglobin S had a different charge?
To the gel, I'm
guessing? Electrophoresis in solution.
Oh, boy.
In solution, absolutely. Right? It's a great paper. It's published around 1949. It's a fantastic paper.
Sucrose or something?
Was the days when ingenuity was king, right? none of these kits and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Boy. I love
my kids. And now we bio-restriction enzymes. We don't make them ourselves.
No, I mean, we used to make our own restriction enzymes. And, this sounds like I made my own log cabin, but it's not such a big deal, you know?
Oh, we make our own tack.
That's crass money reason, right?
Well, not anymore. Technically, the patent is offline, but it's just convenient.
Let's explain what TAC is. It's an enzyme that comes from a thermophile bacteria. When you take the gene out, you express it in regular bacteria. All you have to do is boil the bacteria.
Boil and centrifuge.
And then the only thing left in solution is the proteins that are thermophile, capable of handling boiling water. So
be careful. Alkaline phosphatase. That you can purify alkaline phosphatase that way too.
That's true.
Really?
Out of E. coli.
And I did not know. A friend of mine published the structure of that. Taylor, a guy who Andre knows as well. So that's pretty wild. And it sort of changed the era from, in terms of being able to understand the human genome and initiate the genome project. So how does mapping translate into getting the human genome project going? And who were some of the characters that were involved sort of soliciting the government for the funds to do it. You know, I'd like to know the back, the story that's
seedy
behind
back
the story.
Yeah, well, it wasn't very seedy. It was pretty straightforward. there was a big let's do the scientific piece first. Before linkage mapping, if you knew that something like cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease was inherited, you knew only because of the Mendelian segregation. You knew that it occupied a single place on the genome someplace. That's the mutation of interest was one of 3 billion bases, and if it wasn't X-linked, you knew that it wasn't on the X chromosome, and that's all you knew. Okay, the minute you had a linkage with a physical marker, you could narrow down where that disease was by just correlation with physical markers all over the genome, and ask the question how. How frequently when you look in a family with, let's say, cystic fibrosis, does the disease gene go with your marker? And for most markers, it will go 50-50 and you got nothing, okay? But for some, it'll be closely linked as because it just happens to lie nearby. And if that physical marker is now located, let's say, 10 centimorgans away, so that's 10% recombination. 1% recombination. Then you would actually look at 10% or 1%. Doesn't matter, right? Then you would say, well, there is 3,000 centimorgans in the genome, and so I've now made a purification in terms of where I think this is of 1,000-fold or so. Okay? And you can keep going like that up to a certain point until you get to within 1 million bases or so of your gene. So and so what that meant is that if you could put all the pieces together of the physical genome, that you could actually sequence it all.
And
so everybody was motivated to do that.
I can also refer back to an interview with Dr. Rick Lifton, who sequenced a lot of the genes involved in hypertension this way.
That's right.
Kind of using the reverse fruit fly method. But could you explain, so that it becomes really concrete, because really this is pretty straightforward, but it's still pretty abstract if you're not thinking about the structure of DNA and how these physical markers bind. Right. Maybe you could explain a little bit of the underlying technology, because this is, it was a historic transition.
The underlying technology was very simple. It was what I said before, that it was the southern blot. Take the DNA of an individual, right?
Yep.
And you chop it up with some restriction enzyme that cuts, let's say, every 4,000 bases on the average, and you get a distribution in a gel that separates by size. You get a smear of thousands upon thousands of fragments, average size 4,000 bases, but most of them all different. And now what you do is you take your probe, which is a piece of DNA that you isolated and made radioactive from a clone, let's say, just a random clone. And now you hybridize it to this smear, and you find that the radioactive piece falls in exactly one place.
Okay.
Now, sometimes, because we each have two chromosomes, one from our dad and one from our mom, you don't see one band, but you see two bands. What does that mean? That means that the restriction enzyme site must be missing. That makes a shorter band must be missing from one or the other of your parental chromosomes. And so that means that your parental chromosomes are different, and they differ by a base at that site. And that's called a polymorphism. And that is going to get inherited along with the chromosome. And that is in a particular place in the genome. And you can find out where that place is. Today, you can look it up. I looking at the sequence. But then there were other physical methods of figuring out that it was, let's say, on chromosome 4. And then what we proposed in 1980 was that we collect several hundred such markers, and then we could cover the whole genome, and every inherited gene must be linked to a few of those hundreds of markers. And so it turned out to be. The last time I looked, about 4,500 or 5,000 genes had been located in this way. The first one was in 1983.
That was still a lot of work, right? That was kind of the reason to justifying that, okay, it's going to take us, it's taking us that many number of years to find one gene, such as cystic fibrosis gene. And I think that was kind of the political argument for really, we really need to sequence the whole thing. That way we'll be able to find genes much more faster, right?
That's true. That was one of the winning arguments, that it really turned out that it was obvious to everyone that it was useful to be able to map genes and to find the sequences of the genes, because they told you things. For example, the gene that predisposes to Parkinson's disease turned out to be, when it was actually found, to be a cytochrome P450 or something like that, something having to do with oxidative damage. It was a DNA repair gene, right? And so what that means is, no, it's not cytochrome P450, it was something else. Anyway, I don't have it in front of me. But it was a DNA repair gene having to do with oxidative damage. And so what that told you all of a sudden, that Parkinson's disease was not some simple failure of a neuron, it was really a failure of failure to repair oxidative damage in the brain. And at that time, people weren't thinking about oxidative damage in the brain as being an issue, let alone a problem.
So were you involved in the beginning, for example, in justifying the need for sequencing smaller model organisms before moving into the human genomes? What was the exact implication in the beginning of the process?
So this is has been, you know, well documented many times. There was a big controversy that arose, and I, in fact, originally was an opponent of the human genome sequencing as it was first proposed. The reasons I was an opponent were several. One was the idea was to set up some huge institution somewhere and just do it by brute force, and I didn't like that idea at all. The other is that it was going to be a huge amount of money that was going to be taken away from regular research, and nobody liked that idea. Nobody liked top-down research at all, then or now, I should say.
Especially biologists.
Especially biologists. Finally, the argument that was for me the worst was that there was actually no good way to interpret the sequence. And we all understood that there would be a way to interpret the sequence if you also sequenced other organisms in which you could do experiments. And so you could find, for example, that a human gene was just like a Drosophila gene or a yeast gene that does a certain kind of thing. And then you could experiment on that in the experimental organism. And furthermore, the experimental organisms had, we didn't really know how to sequence either. That was another problem. And so eventually a National Academy of Sciences organized a committee led by Bruce Alberts, on which I served. We discussed the matter seriously in private in Washington
for
a year or so. What?
What year was that?
Good question.
94, 92?
90 something. No, it got to be 88 or something like that.
Oh, even? Okay.
Yeah.
I was basing my time on the fact that the yeast genome came out in 1996. So I figured they probably took 5 or 6 years to do this one. So that's why I was thinking probably in 1992. But like any good research project, it takes years to prepare and get the money.
Oh, absolutely. You know, our colleague at McGill, Bergeron, and a few others, Barak and Yates and Abersold and Mann.
Here we
they're
go.
Putting together a billion-dollar project.
1988 I'll ask about was published in 1988, so the discussion was 86, 87.
Okay.
Excuse me, Dr.
The chair was Bruce Alberts, and it was, I can read you, it was Sidney Brenner and me and Cantor, Russ Doolittle, Lee Hood, Victor McCusick, Daniel Nathans, Maynard Olson, Leon Rosenberg, Frank Ruddle, Shirley Tillman, John Tooze, and Jim Watson.
Wow, that's scary. Wow. I know all these names.
We've only had Lee Hood from that gang on the show so far. Could you, Dr. Botstein, could you move the camera or move your move a little closer to the camera?
All right.
Because we've got a lower third that's crossing. There you go.
Okay.
Perfect. That's great. Yeah, perfect.
All right.
I was thinking about that technical issue. All right, so here's the situation. You've proposed to do it.
Yep.
You've got the method all in place.
Have the method all in place. A big part of the discussion was we had no idea how to do it, really. We knew in principle that it could be done just using Sanger type sequencing, but everybody mm-hmm. hoped and expected, and for a long time believed that. What are now called second generation methods would actually be invented in time. And we were optimistic about that, and we were wrong. It turned out that what actually saved the day was automation. And that was the big contribution
Lee Hood,
of Eric Lander, was organizing the sequencing and automating the standard methods. Using the capillary sequencers and ganging them together and using robots and various automatic methods to prepare the samples and stuff like that. There was a lot of technology development that was required.
So the
sequencing cost fell 100-fold at least over the period.
So are you saying that you need to propose the major project first so that the drive to develop those technologies ahead are done?
Yes, absolutely. It's the NASA effect. If you decide that you're going to go to the moon, whether that's a good idea or not, and it's sufficiently challenging but not impossible, then if people believe in the goal, it drives technology, absolutely. And that certainly happened in the human genome case. So, for example, one of the original plan involved these radioactive probes that were going to be sent all around the country because it was clear that a lot of the physical mapping was very challenging, and some of it was actually quite so challenging that one group didn't believe the other group's results, as they shouldn't. One should be skeptical. And so in order to check, you had to pass a physical probe back and forth. Now, the number of probes that we estimated you would have to use were in the hundreds of thousands at least, and probably in the many millions, okay, at the very minimum. Mm-hmm. And so we were envisioning literally what we used to refer to as the Sears Roebuck warehouse for distribution of probes so that everybody could be on the same page. And then Maynard Olson came up with the idea of the sequence tag site, two PCR primers, where you could just write down the sequence, and if you knew that it was unique in the genome, anybody could write down the sequences of the probes and recover the piece of DNA that you were talking about. So that was a huge... we figured that the Sears Roebuck part was going to cost about a third of the whole genome.
if
you're going to start to spend billions of dollars, you know?
So on at that time, thing. were there companies where you could buy sequences of DNA? I mean, we're talking...
No. Are you kidding?
No, so you had to make your own.
You made your own.
Base by base.
Base. There were solid phase sequencers had been invented by, and ABI was in business, and they made a synthesizer, and we all had one. Then companies started to make sequences, but large scale and cheap sequence availability is only in the 90s.
Oh, yeah, that's just about when I started. But let me say, when I started graduate school, my mentor said, no, you're going to do sequencing the old-fashioned way. No capillary sequencing, no PCR. So that was pretty... Andre, though, who was a postdoc in that lab, actually got to...
I got to do Maxime Gilbert during my master's degree. That was pleasant.
That's how I learned to sequence. That was not pleasant.
Yeah, pouring your gels yourself, like they were essentially less than 1 millimeter thick gels that were essentially the size of about a meter long, that if one air bubble would go in while you were pouring this big thing, your whole gel was wasted, not to mention the number of times.
You got to be very good at that or you got into a lot of trouble.
Yes, and also drying such a big gel was not fun.
But the other thing, which was a big selling point eventually to the community, was that we made a calculation of what fraction of, for example, the yeast community was really surprisingly resistant to the idea of sequencing. And I really had a very hard time after the compromise selling this to my own community. And when I remember going to one meeting in Wisconsin, and there was a huge amount of, you know, concern. And then we hit upon the idea of trying to get an estimate of what fraction of all the grants it was being spent on amateur sequencing. Because what was happening at the time is somebody would discover a gene, they would map it, they would clone it, and then some graduate student would spend literally a year sequencing a kilobase.
That was my master's degree. That was my first paper, a PhD, DNA.
Right? What?
I'm actually very surprised that the yeast community...
When you guys came in the door, must have been about then, and it was a third of all the money that was being spent on research in yeast was spent on what I called amateur sequencing.
I think the yeast community is the one that actually has the most benefited from having the genome sequence of its model organism, considering all the wonderful things that they've done with it since. There's still good stuff being done in the other models, but certainly not as much as yeast.
No, I think so. I mean, once the sequence was actually there, and it was there ahead of schedule and under budget, blah blah blah. Once this sequence was actually in place, everybody pretty quickly understood that this was good news, and that it really had no downside.
Well, I remember the transition from the point where the database was just a sketchy database of genes in that you could scan. You had a little segment of, so you sequence 300 bases. You don't know what it is. It's just long enough to throw out there against the database, and you come back. I remember the day where it went from, you know, just being a subset of sequences that you were lined up to a point where, let's go into the genome. It's this chromosome. It's this gene, right? An undefined gene, but you knew where that started, where the gene ended. You knew if there was introns, you knew where the promoter was. And that was a huge transition.
That was a huge transition. And I think that in many ways, my being on that committee gave me the foresight to realize that the really interesting part for me was going to be the database. And so I organized the Saccharomyces genome database and recruited Mike Cherry to the job. And we really made it into a community resource, which is still in very heavy use. And I thought that was the most interesting part. I thought the actual sequencing part was relatively boring, but connecting the sequence with function, that was the part that floated my boat.
Well, that's the hard part, right?
Yeah. What's the point of doing things if they're easy?
Well, you were talking about connecting sequence with function. That's a pretty good segue to one of the many outputs of the genome sequences would be the microarray technologies, which you were heavily involved in, and that's one that's of special interest to me.
Well, that's a really simple. The history of that is well known. There are basically two sources. The person who had the idea first appears to be Ed Southern, and he told me about it around 1982, and he eventually won all the patent suits of Oxford University in Oxford Biosciences, I think, in the end, defeated all the other patents. But the guys who first really reduced it to practice in a serious way were Affymetrix on the one hand and Pat Brown on the other. Pat Brown was a professor, a young professor at Stanford, and shortly after he started doing this kind of thing, he did it for some completely other reason, which we can go into, but it's sort of a diversion. We were collaborating about something else, and it occurred to both of us that developing this in order to study cancer would be a really good idea, but neither of us were particularly comfortable. Neither of us were cancer researchers. We're particularly comfortable with administrative and sort of, overhead of running a large lab to do this. But we decided that we would do it together. And so we did. We made a joint lab in which we sort of ramped up the whole microarray technology to the point where you could take a bunch of breast cancers or a bunch of lymphomas and compare them. And when we started doing that, we realized that what was really missing was actually sort of similar to sequence analysis. What was really missing was methods of analysis. And so we started to think a lot. And Pat is himself a mathematician, and I'm sort of an amateur. Quantitative type, and I've already been through the linkage mapping thing, which involved a lot of math. And so with the linkage mapping thing, I'd sort of, recruited Eric Lander into, who was then a mathematician, into this this business. And so we found Mike Eisen, and Eisen came up with this, the clustering methods that you're all familiar with. And using the clustering methods and, just homebrew microarrays, we're able to detect subtypes of lymphoma and lung cancer and breast cancer especially. And it was clear that this was going to be the first, truly genome scale use of the sequence.
So this is a systems approach. Go ahead.
Go, Mark.
Okay. So this is a transition where you've got the human genome or the yeast genome or what genome you're probing, and you're now able to see that genome in action, right? Because it detects what genes are turned on and turned off.
Yeah, before to some you extent. Answer, I'll mean, ask you know, to within, move your within camera reason. Down.
Yeah. If you could please point your camera down a little bit, maybe that would be the easiest way to do it for the best angle. Go to your camera and just, is it an eyesight?
Yeah.
Yeah, so just take point it,
turn it down
towards your chest. Yeah, even a little bit more because it'll correct itself. Perfect. You Fine. Always want the top of your head just slightly cut because, in a sense, in the semiotic way, you're showing that you have an open mind.
Well, thanks.
I think so. So, but yeah, so we're transitioning now, okay, from a point where we know what the genome is, but we don't know its function. We know some of its function. Then you need to watch the genome work, and you do it with homebrew microarrays.
That's how we started, yeah.
You printed your own chips?
Yes. We still do sometimes.
I still do.
Exactly. Maybe you guys could explain that, and then what does it mean
there are two reasons. There are two reasons that we did it in the first place. One was that it was insanely expensive to get Affymetrix to do anything for you.
Yes.
By our lights, the result that we got wasn't very good. The other thing is both Pat and I were, and I think remain, persuaded that two colors is really essential to get good data. And the Affymetrix aren't bright enough to really do two colors, although Mark Chi did do it once or twice. But we were never able to get the Affymetrix even later, much later, to do well in two colors. But the most important thing was the expense. And the other thing is that, I've always been a teaching shop. And what making your own does is it means that our alumni became the leaders of the field because they all had to learn how to do everything for themselves. And so as a consequence,
So these chips have, now that you've got the genome, you've put every single gene in little segments onto this chip and you probe it with...
Well, all the coding parts. We tried for all the coding parts.
Okay, so all the things that are make proteins.
Yeah.
And so you're still using microarrays for most of your studies, as I've noticed as I was reading it. Actually, there was something, as I was reading for this interview, Mark invited me to participate maybe about 2 hours ago. So,
one thing,
I've been aware of a lot of your work since.
It's a lot of reading.
One that had really caught my eye. I've been reading your papers on and off for many years, so that I wasn't starting totally from scratch. But one which I missed, which I actually found pretty fascinating, was a little something you wrote called "It's the Data." Is that it's essentially where you were commenting
I wrote that for NBC.
Just to keep it just quick introduction, and then you can take it from there. Essentially, you've noticed that some of your papers published in the probably early 2000s are still being cited at a really incredible rate, not necessarily because of the conclusion of these papers, but the data that was measured in them turns out to be still useful and still obviously data that bioinformaticians like to play with.
Right. That's true. And we are, you know, in our own defense, and in fact, I quote from a paper that Pat and I wrote in 1999, at the time that these data were being produced, that our whole idea was that it was important that the data remain available. And that was, you know, led indirectly to PLOS and the whole issue of, supplemental data and, what's the good of having a paper if the data are not available. And so we sort of predicted that this was going to be a problem. And because I was at the time editor in chief of that journal, we were able to arrange it in such a way that the data remained safe. And as a consequence, those papers have been used as test beds for all kinds of bioinformatics, and also for just people who want to know what their gene does in a certain circumstance. Because we did a lot of really exploratory, non-hypothesis-driven stuff in those days just to sort of explore the dynamics of the genome a little bit. And those turned out to be really interesting papers for me, but the particular results that we had were not necessarily so notable. I mean, everybody knew there were cell cycle-regulated genes, and we found, to a first approximation, we found them all in one experiment. But for various people working on individual genes, even today, if they want to know what is this gene cell cycle regulated, one of the best places to look is in that data set, because it's been done again, but only once or twice, and the results are not that different. So the consequence of all of that is people are still citing these papers because they found some little tidbit of data useful. It's the same as citing the sequence of a genome of a gene. People still cite papers for sequences of genes.
Can I ask you a question? Both as a journal editor been a journal editor for many years in many journals, and also somebody who's been using microarrays. I've noticed sometimes the challenge in getting this technology published is that sometimes not every reviewer has the ability to get the data into their own analysis software and see if the conclusions are warranted that the data is in here. It's something that personally, when I'm a reviewer on these type of paper, I always do. And very often I'm kind of horrified by what I see once I get access to the raw data. And I was kind of curious if it's something that you've encountered yourself. Sometimes you get the microarray data and you wish you could just dive into it before concluding that the conclusions are right or not.
Well, I'm a little bit of a hard case in this. If I can't get the data, I won't review the paper. And I go back to the journal. This is why I have, only formal relations with things like Nature and Science, because they refuse to insist that the data be given up. So sometimes they do. I did review a paper recently for one of them, and what was very interesting in that case was that they said that they have three biological replicates. And so I went to the supplemental data, blah, blah, blah. I fished out the biological replicates, and they did have three biological replicates, but the results weren't the same.
Oh, lovely.
So, And also having the raw data as part of the review process.
They just chose the one that they like, right?
Right.
No, I mean, look, this has been a problem in publishing from the beginning. It's the magnitude of the problem has become much, much worse. And you're right. Most reviewers don't bother to look at the data. There's a level of trust there, which I think is actually unwise.
But it's also, you don't want to share your data. Well, I guess you want to submit a paper, but what about the threat of a person saying, reject the paper, there's the data? I guess there should be signatures in the data set that say that data is
too complex.
I don't think there's a lot of that. Everybody worries about that, but I think the much greater sin is that nobody ever looks at the data at all. Especially now with the advent of PLOS One, if you're really worried about that, it's obvious what you should do. You should put the data out there in PLOS One tomorrow and worry about the fine points later. Certainly, if you send it to some high-profile journal and they say no thanks, then you better turn around and get it published quickly. But you can now. It's not a problem.
Let me turn this. We're going to run short on time fairly soon, and I'm wondering if we should talk a little bit about how you're using yeast and to develop some of the methods for systems biology, genome scale studies, and but I think the topic of your research on experimental evolution in yeast and genome wide expression during that. That kind of data seem really, really cool. So, or would you like to talk about the work or the education elements?
Well, actually, I would like to talk a little bit about the education because just as Pat and I realized. Eric and I realized that the math and the computation was going to be important in sequence analysis and linkage mapping and people still arguing about what GWAS means, right? That on the one hand, and the microarrays required all kinds of revisions of even very basic statistics in some cases, I think that the rate limiting step now is actually not journals and publishing or even the expense of microarrays. I think the rate limiting step now is in analysis. And the reason for that is that most biologists have the math and physics that they came into college with. And
usually high school.
Yeah, they had it from high school, right. It's rare to find a straightforward cell biologist or microbiologist who has more than elementary calculus, so basic physics. And that doesn't mean they haven't learned more along the way. That's not the point. Point is it's not a standard part of our curriculum. And partly also the fact that it isn't a standard part of our curriculum means that many quantitative types just turn away from biology altogether because what turns them on is the sort of quantitative problem-solving kind of stuff. And the future of our science is that we need this kind of stuff. So what we're doing here is an experiment of really trying to get those two branches back together again, or more exactly, catching the interested students before they differentiate and start to say, oh, all that biology is just petal counting, or they say, all that math is just, speculative nonsense, and try to teach modern science in a new way, in such a way that they don't lose contact with the other fields just because they choose one of them.
And you know what the first thing a systems biologist does in the presentation after showing a formula? He usually apologizes.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There is also, to be fair, a lot of showing in formulas just to show how smart you are, where, a simple couple of words would have done well. I mean, you don't need to show the whole correlation formula every time you do Pearson, correlations. Anyway. The reality is that the young people understand that this is important. And at least the ones who really are serious about a scientific career are really willing to learn. So we teach them computation up front. They learn Java and MATLAB. We teach the physics and the chemistry and the biology as much as we can together. So, for example, when we get to, and we try to organize it at least in the beginning around the mathematical descriptions of reality. So when we get to things that you would describe with ordinary differential equations, you know, we'll have second order differential equations to describe the laws of motion, and then a couple of days later, chemists come along and use exactly the same mathematical apparatus to look at the rates of reactions. And then I'll come along and introduce, DNA reassociation kinetics and calculate the size of the genome, all using the same simple second-order differential equations. And the students really like that. So we think we're making headway. I'm trying to interest other places in doing something similar. They're not going to be able to do exactly what we do for a variety of reasons. Each university has different issues. But the principle that we shouldn't allow the students to differentiate prematurely into hidebound physicists and biologists or computer scientists, I think that principle is one that is actually rate limiting for the future of biology.
It is catching on. McGill University has now a side program in its graduate school to do a human systems biology, where essentially courses in mathematics and bioinformatics are being taught along with the usual courses in biology.
Well, that's good to hear. We have started such a graduate program here, but I think that the real frontier is at the undergraduate. And I'll tell you why. It's very similar to the business about language, and it really is about language. It's about communication. So everybody knows that if you take a kid from one culture and one language and move him to another culture and another language, typically immigration to the United States or Canada, what happens is the outcome is a very strong function of the age of the kid when moved. If the kid is below about 10, they will end up speaking recipient country's language, essentially without an accent, idiomatic English. For example, I am not a native born American. I was born in Switzerland. My family moved here when I was 7. Okay, and people can't tell that my native language is not English. But if I were 14 or something like that when we came here, then I would sound like Schwarzenegger or Kissinger, right?
But then again, both Mark and I are French Canadian.
Yeah, so when did you learn English, Andre?
I pretty much by osmosis. I mean,
at what age?
Yeah. No, really, really learning English is when I did my PhD at the University of North Carolina. That's when I lost my accent.
But you still have a detectable accent, if I may say.
Yeah, a little bit. Because I've been back in Montreal for 15 years. I actually had a Southern accent when I came back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Some people, but the generalization, my neighbor here is Leonid Krugliak, and he has a brother, Semyon, and Semyon's English, he's much younger, 3 or 4 years, and Semyon's English is essentially unaccented, and Leonid sounds like he has a Russian accent, and it's okay. They both communicate perfectly well, but the further on you get, the more difficult it is.
And I agree with that.
I think that where we should start is at the very beginning of university, in college in the United States.
Learning those languages, getting a real handle of the tools that are necessary to really crank at the mathematics in a systemic way.
Right? And computation. I think programmers is also something which is best learned when you're a teenager.
Absolutely. I think I was 11 when I learned my first little tidbits of assembly language on a VIC-20.
There you go. Stuff. Okay, and what you don't want to do is you don't want to lose that momentum just because someone decides to be a biologist.
Yeah, no, and I regret it because right now we're faced with problems in the lab where if I was just fluent in MATLAB, or it would be just such relief and we could get through the data. So otherwise, we're using tools that are certainly not optimal to get through mountains of data. And we're compensating by spending 8 hours using Excel, right? So,
we don't use Excel. Basically, if one of our guys uses Excel, it's a mark. They won't admit it. Okay.
Thank you.
Although the fashion now is sort of moving away from MATLAB and into R.
Oh, but R is okay. So user fiendish compared to MATLAB. It's just. I mean, I'm able to handle MATLAB, but R is just too much for my old brain.
Well, we all use what we're used to. So when I really have to do this, I don't say this out loud. I use Mathematica because that's what I have. It's okay. But you get the point. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to get away from the sort of traditional chemistry, physics, biology. They're all different. They're all different languages into a more high level sort of consensus view of the world where, probability and statistics is what is important and is taught early and from first principles. And non-parametric methods are used because you have access to the computer and stuff like that.
Well, people at the graduate school level can then specialize on whatever scientific question they can drive
That's
towards,
right?
And then they have all the tools they need to really get it.
Yeah. There are we graduate physicists as well and computer scientists as well as biologists. I mean, about a third of our students are physics majors in the end.
You know, I guess one way to tackle this in the past was to create large labs with, group labs where you'd have two or three people coming together, a physicist, a biologist, and a chemist. It's really, I suppose it's looking back at education, it was really hard to become an expert in all things, at least for me. So, my chemistry is very weak, but I'm working with some great chemists. But it'd be nice to people have a good handle.
We're not arguing that everybody is going to know everything. I don't think that's a realistic goal. But we do want everybody to learn the language, at least at some elementary level, of all the fields so that they can converse in the language and the mathematics that's appropriate to each field.
And not ask you for 1 sec to unplug your headset and plug it back in. You're after 1 hour, the DSP-400 always Cylons. So unplug it, plug it flat back in, please. And
okay, how's that?
Now you're. Can you say test? Check.
Test.
Yeah, perfect. Great. So that's really interesting, and it's great to know that we can recruit your graduates.
Okay, of course. We got the graduates right now are going to Harvard. They're going to MIT, Harvard Systems. They're going to MIT. They're going to Stanford. They're going to biophysics places, University of Washington, Seattle, places like that. But two of our fellows, we have these Lewis Sigler fellows mm-hmm. who are sort of straight out of graduate school, and they have get independent research money from us, and they help us teach. And those guys, two of them, went to the University of Toronto.
Wow. Well, we could try
because
to
you know Brenda Andrews and Charlie Boone run a great operation up there.
Yeah, they do awesome stuff.
Yeah, they do.
Well, we actually lost one of our graduate students to them. Well, lost. He graduated and moved to do his postdoc with Charlie Boone.
We call that a success down south of the border.
Yep. Well, of course, we for like anybody who's moved from Montreal to Toronto, we made sure to give him a big red Canadian shirt for him to wear proudly when he's down there.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my shirt. I've got a flag somewhere in the lab. Hey, it's been absolutely a joy and a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm going to ask you one, maybe as a closing question. So a colleague from McGill, John Bergeron, who together with Dr. I can't pronounce it, Barak, Yates, John Yates at Scripps, Ambersold, yeah. Mann, and Nilsson in Nature Methods just this September proposed doing the Human Proteome Project, which is similar. Is it similar in scale to the Human Genome Project? I think it is because some of the technologies are in place, some need to be invented. It's probably at least a $1 billion project to map out the human anatomy down to the atomic level. Do you have any advice on for them? Because John's going to be on the show with a few of his colleagues to propose this and to follow up on his Nature Meds paper. Do you have any suggestions to push it through?
No, not really. I think that thinking big is a good thing. I do think that mass spectrometry is coming of age. The one thing that I would strongly advocate is to liberate the software from the manufacturers. What you want is things like, the freestanding analysis suites that you have for microarrays. You do not want to be dependent on Affymetrix or Agilent in the case of microarrays. And to a very large extent, the fact that we went homebrew and made our own analysis greatly speeded up the diffusion of the technology. Because we weren't dependent on the software. And remember that sequencing got a 50 to 100-fold increase in efficiency when Phil Green brought in Fred and Frapp and quality scores and all that sort of stuff instead of people trying to figure out what the sequence was from the software that came with the sequencing machines. Right now, in the mass spectrometry world, there isn't a lot of third-party open source software that you can use, and I think that much of the success of this is going to depend on having that on the one hand and free access to the data on the other. If nobody does what Pat and I did with the data, then even more important, what the sequencers did, daily release of mm-hmm. the data, that was in many ways the key decision.
That's brilliant.
So that everybody has access to the data, so that everybody can use it, and so forth and so on. And because the people who hoard the data in the hope that they're going to find some Nobel Prize winning tidbit 3 years down the line, these guys, that never happens that way.
All right. You cannot get any better parting words, Mel.
Open source. All right. Open source. Hey, I look forward to playing around with the data as it comes off the machines. I mean,
absolutely. That's what I think is the future for much of this stuff. Because you can't know what's important when you're doing these high throughput things. You just can't.
I guess it makes it simpler for people who are going to review the articles as they get published. If they have access to the software, not only people who have paid $500,000 for an MS mass spec to have access to the $30,000 software that's running on that machine.
Absolutely. Plus, when I get one of these microarray things, I get the data out. I put it into, sometimes with some difficulty, into the right table format. And then I submit it to Java Tree View, which is what I'm used to looking at. And I see what I see, right? Mm-hmm. And you can't do that with mass spec stuff yet, but you should.
So science, open source, I mean, science really it benefits from open source.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Especially in the large scale projects that we're going to help us move forward in our human biotech, right?
That's right.
Well, it's been amazing. I really appreciate you coming on. It's been an honor and to have to get the firsthand account really is really what this is about. And so thank you very much. Today's guest is Dr. David Botstein, Anthony B. Evnin, Professor of Genomics and Director of the Lewis Sigler Institute for Integrative Genomics at Princeton University. So thank you. And
bye-bye.
Our co-host was Andre Nantel, who is a senior research officer at the Biotech Research Institute, Microarray Lab, National Research Council of Canada in Montreal. He also has a fantastic photo blog called Digital Apoptosis. I'll spell it really quick. DigitalApoptosis.com.
I should make up a sign.
You should call it something simple.
Well, all the good domain names were taken when I made it, so...
Can somebody email me that? Doing DNA I'm not going to get there unless somebody does.
Sure. I will. DigitalApoptosis.com. Yeah, for the scientifically minded. Fantastic photo blog. He travels the world for science and brings a camera along. My favorite work is his HDR work on architecture. So please do more of that. It's just absolutely stunning. You've got a really keen eye, and maybe that's what helps you with the science. You can see data that's beautiful, and that's helped you with your genomics as well. So Andre, thank you for coming on such short notice. I called you like an hour and a half before the show.
I know, it's always a pleasure.
You're a subject matter expert in the area of genomics for Futures in Biotech. So thank you. I'd also like to thank our new producer, Eric Lanigan, producer of Futures in Biotech over in Petaluma. Likes to thank Leo Laporte for making this possible, giving us the opportunity to talk science and to talk biotech. I'd also like to thank Lisa Kentzel, Tony Wang, Frederic Louis, Mike Taylor, John Salinina, Ken Shepherdson. And also like to thank Bert McQuinn for handling the boards, doing the recording, and being really patient with a lot of the technical issues that we have during the show. Thank you, Bert. I'd also like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If there are any comments or suggestions, you can email me at mark@twit.tv, or on Twitter, you can send me a comment. It's Mark Pelletier, MarcPelletier. Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelletier.